The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It is the Anton Savage Show, 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. If you'd like to get in touch, or 087 1400 106, you can do it for free on WhatsApp. I'm joined this morning by Mamobo Ogoro, who's presenter of Unified on News Talk Sunday at 8 p.m, and Peter Leonard, barrister who specialises in employment law and judicial review. And unusually, there is one word that is shared across all of the front of the papers today: the Mail, the Independent, the Examiner and the Times. Their front pages all include the word avoidable, and that's in relation to the death of Aoife Johnston. The Irish Times has it in their headline: Aoife Johnston's death avoidable. Same with the Irish Examiner: Aoife Johnston's death was avoidable. That quote then is in the piece in the Irish Independent, and it's also in the front of the Daily Mail. But what the Daily Mail uses as their banner headline is catastrophic. A devastating report says, quote, Aoife should, and this is what the Mail, how they put it, should have been treated in UHL within 10 minutes. Amid staff shortages, chronic overcrowding and confusion among medics, she died after a 13-hour wait for antibiotics. And Mamobo, one of the things that the report done by the former Chief Justice says is that during that period, her parents did everything that they possibly could to try to catalyse treatment for her and try to help her. And nonetheless, they ended up watching their child die unnecessarily in front of them.
I cannot believe to imagine the amount of anguish and pain that the parents must have been feeling in that moment. Watching your child descent into just the sickness and even death in this case is something that is unimaginable. And I was even reading this morning that the parents are even starting to feel frustration to the delays that are actually occurring when it comes to the story as well. So the amount of pain and actually reliving the grief and the pain and the anguish that they were having in that moment is something that's very catastrophic, as it was said in this morning.
And of course, the other thing that the report says is that it not only was Aoife Johnston's death almost certainly avoidable, but that there is a likelihood of a similar kind of incident happening again, given the level of overcrowding that regularly occurs in University Hospital Limerick.
And it's something that's very, like the likelihood of that's going to happen again is because there's an adequate systemic change that needs to happen within the health system and within the hospital as well. So unfortunately, I believe that without that level of systems change, without that level of support that's needed for the care staff, the medical staff there to actually reduce the overflow of the hospitals, fortunately, I believe things like this will happen again.
The report details, and it's one of the things, Peter, in a lot of the papers that they do, is they break down the timeline of Aoife Johnston's treatment on arrival. It's awful to read because it is one of those where you can't point to a single individual who said, would that they had acted differently. But the chaos, the overcrowding and the completely unnecessary descent into death of this young woman.
It's absolutely shocking, Anton. And I think, in fairness, the former Chief Justice, Frank Clark, has to be commended. There was some complaints by the solicitor for the family during the week about the nature of the investigation and whether findings of fact had been made.
Damien Tansey.
Damien Tansey, who's the solicitor for the family. And you can understand that. I mean, as Mamobo says, I mean, the grief and the experience that the family had. And I think the Chief Justice said in it, the former Chief Justice said in it, you know, to be there present at the time and being unable to help, it is just absolutely horrific. But I mean, the facts are set out in great detail, and I think that is very helpful in terms of trying to get an understanding of what happened. So, I mean, she went to the hospital at about 20 to 6 on the 16th of December, and she was given a letter by her GP, so you think that's enough, and it was suspected septicemia and dehydration. So that was brought into the triage in the ED, in the ED department in UHL. And a nurse picked up on that, and I think she was supposed to be sent to this resus centre. That seems to be the place that you go to, and she was a category 2 triage patient at that stage, so therefore she should have been sent there. But because of overcrowding, because of a lack of availability, she was sent to a different section. And I think there the message didn't get through that she needed this specific treatment.
In layperson's terms, had she been in the resus room, everybody would have known she was likely sepsis and acted accordingly. Because she wasn't in that room, it got dropped between two stools, the fact that she had a likely diagnosis.
Absolutely, that seems to be the problem. And, you know, the place is massively overcrowded. It would appear that the roster was down 5 nurses on the night in question. Now, that can happen. Staffing issues arise all the time. It was down 1 doctor. But there was 167 people on trolleys in the emergency department that evening. So the whole thing was chaotic. And she was sent to the wrong department. And it appears at various different stages, nurses who were dealing with her and dealing with the family were picking up on the fact that she needed to be sent to this resus department and were communicating to people there. But they were saying, listen, we can't take her in for whatever reason. I suppose it's, you know, the purpose of what this investigation was to find out information and to make recommendations. As we said earlier, the solicitor for the family, and there will be other matters down the line, we're looking for findings of fact. That couldn't be done in the context of this, but it was more information as to how did this happen and get a proper evaluation of how it happened.
One of the things that Frank Clark says in the report, Mamobo, is that this level of overcrowding, he's careful around it. He says it is not normal, though it is regular and frequent enough to be seen as the normality of how the hospital operates. The reality is everybody you talk to has a friend or relative who has sat for 12 hours, 16 hours, 24 hours, 30 hours in A&E. It is the norm that people suffer through hours and days waiting in overcrowded A&Es. Is it just something that is a function of the system and we'll never get it changed?
To be honest, I don't know if that's going to be the way that things are going to be. And it's very sad to actually see that people, and I haven't been there myself, actually have to wait for that amount of time. I actually have a cousin who's a nurse in UHL, and she feels the pressure in terms of being medical staff, having to wait on people and knowing the system change that is necessary. And sometimes you can feel kind of hopeless or you can't even do anything to cause that change. So I feel that without those level, implementing the recommendations that have been made, without that, it's just unfortunately going to stay as it is.
And that's what he says. He says, unless and until that problem, this being the issue to do with overcrowding, unless and until that problem is addressed, a risk of reoccurrence will inevitably be present. And he describes it in the report as gross and chaotic overcrowding at the hospital with 168 patients on trolleys. And of course, pre-existing reports warning that there needed to be investment and changes.
He refers to the fact that there was a report prepared in 2009, which identified problems in UHL and that needed to be addressed, and they weren't addressed. Now, I suppose the significance of this report is, while giving information, which obviously is very important in terms of what's going to happen in relation to this case going forward, but I think it is noteworthy that a lot of people have now piled in as a result of that. The Consultants Association, the trade unions representing nurses, Sheila Nye was on, Bernard Gloucester himself is talking about it. So hopefully something will be done as a result of this. And that, you know, this horrible overcrowding. And I mean, it would appear that over the years, emergency departments in Ennis and in Nina, which would feed into Limerick, were closed down. And maybe that was a mistake. Mm. Who knows? I mean, it's not for me to comment on the management of hospitals. I don't know from a distance. But clearly, 168 people on trolleys is absolutely crazy.
And as
crazy.
You say, Sheila Nye again, she's quoted in the Mail's coverage saying, our members have long felt and expressed deep frustrations arising from the failure of the entire system to respond effectively or at all when clinical concerns were raised. Justice Clark's report and the systems analysis review by medical and nursing experts commissioned by the HSE must be the catalyst for meaningful and lasting change in respect of overcrowding. If you want to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. I mentioned earlier on that there was a poll in the Irish Times in respect of politics and in respect of the likely makeup of the next government and what would people want. And essentially, Mamobo, what it says is that people want what people currently have. Are you surprised at this apparent desire for the status quo?
I think in terms of people wanting what they currently have, I don't know if I can be surprised at it because of all of us have our certain ways that we actually act and ways that we have in this in our lives. So I think in terms of the status quo, it is what it is, you know.
Well, to give some of the breakdown of the numbers, which of the parties, if any, would you not like to see in government? The prime amongst them, Sinn Féin at 37%, then the Green Party at 26%, Fianna Fáil at 19% and Fine Gael at 18%. When would you like the general election to be? Wait until next year is 35%. This year is 35%. And no difference is 27%. I suspect if they asked, would you like to hear this question asked one more time on air, you might get a bigger percentage out of that. What do you make, Peter, of the resurgence of the status quo? Because 18 months ago, the world and its mother had decided we were going to have a government led by Sinn Féin, with possibly Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael as a junior party, and there has been a total upheaval.
It's hard to figure it out. There's a couple of factors, though, that you can put your finger on. I mean, first of all, it has to be said, Fine Gael have been in power in Ireland since 2011. Now, that is a lengthy period of time. Surely people are getting tired of a government led by Fine Gael. But what they have done is, I mean, the changer of leadership, Simon Harris coming in, has injected energy. I mean, he was up 17 points in the Irish Times poll, you know, in terms of popularity, way ahead. Like, he's hit the ground running and then some. I mean, he is Duracell bully, all the cliches in terms of his energy and what he's doing. And he's also taken a stand on various different issues. Now, he probably hasn't had that many serious matters to deal with in terms of major, you know, economic problems or whatever. Things have been rolling. But he did sort of address the issue of immigration initially. Maybe it's a sticking plaster, but he was seen to do some
lucky general. I mean, there huge is a lucky huge general. Amount of budget surplus, and now Apple flinging 14 billion quid at us as well. Not a bad position.
But I think the big thing about him is he's showing that he wants the job and he has energy and he wants to take it on board. And people are impressed by that. And if you look at Sinn Féin, I mean, 5 years in opposition is a long period of time. And when you're chipping away and giving out all the time, it can run its course a little bit and people can get fed up. And, you know, recently they launched their new housing initiative and that was their big shot. But it doesn't appear, in terms of the recent polling anyway, to be having any impact. And they seem to be stalling around, you know, 17, 18% now, on the same level as Fianna Fáil. I noticed when the breakdown of the figures were, Sinn Féin were only on 13% in Dublin. I mean, that would be shocking from their point of view.
Although
in terms of a general election going forward.
I assume what the party and what Eoin Óibrín would say is, if you have just launched a policy that is 119 pages long and extreme in its detail, it takes time to get people to understand.
So you reckon people are sitting at the bar counter with a pint and they're going through this in great detail?
Well,
I don't know. I mean, the flavour of it will have...
It takes a few weeks for it to percolate.
Well, it can percolate, of course. And let's not be... I shouldn't be trite in terms of the comments I say.
I'll be trite. Go
on. But it is... I think, I mean, the message has gone through. I think anybody who is interested in housing will have picked up on what they're suggesting in relation to it. But if you look again at the figures in the Irish Times, I mean, housing is not at the top. Cost of living seems to be the big issue now. It seems to have replaced housing. I think it was something like 30% said, now I'm kind of quoting from memory here, Anton, during the week, but I think it was sort of cost of living was at the highest. Then housing was down with health maybe at 18%, immigration down at 12%. So there's been a shift. There's definitely been a shift in the public's attitude. But it does definitely look like more of the same come an election, be it in November, be it in February or March.
One final thing on politics before we move on. There's a lot of coverage, Mumobo, on the appointment of Michael McGrath as the EU commissioner. And in the Examiner, they break down the letter from the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, to Michael McGrath, saying, look, here's the brief and here's what you're required to do. One, lead a new European democracy shield to address the most severe risks to democracy in the EU. Two, step up the EU's fight against foreign information manipulation and interference and improve the ability to detect, analyse and deal with and provide counter threats. Three, develop responses to disinformation, improve digital literacy and prevention of disinformation through pre-bunking. And there are another four, five, six in total. Well, he has a fair task ahead of him, doesn't he?
Especially as someone that may not have come from that background as well. And I know that he's come from the finance and financial background. So it's very difficult for someone to actually counter that, especially on an EU level. So the question for me is basically, can he actually do what he's supposed to be doing?
It's quite the remit.
The line I loved in the paper today, Matt Cooper goes big on this. This has been filling a lot of column inches during the week. I mean, Michael McGrath, did he get a proper job? Did he not? There was a piece in the Irish Times. Eoin Dre, who's an insider in Europe, said, no, this shows our standing has sunk dramatically.
It's not an economic portfolio.
And then Barry Andrews came back and fought back and said, no, this is a proper gig and the whole thing. But I noticed Matt Cooper today, and I like the phrase, and it's kind of play on the famous Seamus Brennan line about you're playing senior hurling there, lads. Remember to the Greens all those years ago? Matt Cooper reckons he's playing intermediate hurling at best.
There is something, Peter, that you will be able to explain, given that you are a barrister and therefore have been in the August Chambers of the Law Library and yada, yada, yada. Simeon Burke of the Burke family, brother of Enoch, brother of Amy, is aggrieved that he is unable to find a position as a devil. His family is also aggrieved, his mother and sister showing up at the ploughing championships to raise their grievances with representatives, I think, of the Bar Council, if I can't remember which stand they were at. I was slightly surprised the Bar Council was at the ploughing championships. That's a side issue. Now, what's the issue with devilling? For those who have never devilled nor considered taking silk, how's it work?
Can I have an easier question, please, Anton? No. So look. This is. You know, it sounds. You know, bizarre to people. Basically, if you want to be a barrister, you go to a place called the King's Inns. You do 2 years there, and you qualify. And you're called to the bar. But before you can get up and running as a barrister, you know, and represent clients properly in court, you have to do a year of devilling. So you join with a senior junior counsel, not a senior counsel, a junior counsel, and you work alongside them. And it's a very kind
of ad hoc.
So
if I was a plumber, it would be an apprenticeship.
Apprenticeship, yeah. But it's not as formal as that. An apprenticeship is a proper kind of relationship where you're committed to somebody and there's an exam at the end of it. This is kind of, you know, you go along with somebody and you kind of look over the shoulder and you're allowed to participate in what they're doing. And depending on who your master is, to use the old-fashioned phrase, you might have a wonderful devilling experience. But there are other people who don't get the same access.
And is it an old boys' club? Is it based on who you know that you get access?
Well, there could be an element of that. There could be an element of that. But, I mean, generally, most people are approachable. And if they take devils and they have a vacancy and somebody rings up, yeah, you take it. No problem. So that would generally be the way here. So Simeon Burke has been, you know, did very well in his exams. I think he came first in the law, the King's Inns annual exam or the final exam and did very well in it. And he has been kind of trying to come in, but he's been otherwise occupied as well because he's been helping his brother Enoch, who we know is a resident of the state at the moment and has been for over 400 days as a result of strong views he expressed as a teacher in Wilson's Hospital.
Well, I think as a result of the manner in which those views were expressed as opposed to the views themselves.
Yes. Okay, well, maybe that's a more correct statement. But Simeon has been involved and he is now saying that nobody will take him on as a devil. Now, I don't know about that. He has written to the Bar Council chairman. He's come back and said, look, there are maybe potential options there for you. We'll extend the time a little bit. But it's a matter for yourself to go out and hook up with somebody. But in the meantime, his mother and sister were at the ploughing championships. The Bar Council apparently had a stand. That I didn't know anything about. I presume talking about how the bar can be relevant to people from the agricultural community. And apparently people who were representing the bar on that stand were criticised and attacked and by Simeon's mother and sister.
Verbally,
and apparently, yeah, verbally, of course. And Simeon apparently videoed it, according to the paper today. So, and it was put up on a website that they used to kind of promote Enoch's cause. So, look, it's kind of a difficult one. I mean, in one way, there shouldn't be any restrictive practice which is stopping a talented and well qualified young fella from entering the profession that he wants to enter. You know, I would have generally a strong view in relation to that. But there are a lot of factors in the background and it is an unofficial arrangement. You know, it's one of these things where you kind of got to get on with the person you're working with. So maybe that's where the difficulties lie.
Anton. Peter, thank you very much. Likewise, thank you to Mamobo. That is Peter Leonard, barrister specialising in employment law and judicial review, and Mamobo Ogoro, who is presenter of Unified on News Talk Sunday.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.